that's no problem. But it's just interesting that this really hasn't been investigated if that's that bad. I had a 200 millivolt output on my speaker, and I reduced it to 0.002, which should be 20 dB down, I believe.
That's exactly right. You also were hearing a hissing noise coming out of the loudspeaker, and the hissing noise got a whole lot quieter when you turned up the signal generated to minus 79. Is that true?
Exactly.
You did a reasonable test. As long as you were really on frequency, and you have no reason to doubt that the when you set the Gigatronics to 146.850, and you swished around with the receiver, you know that that was really on frequency, and you really measured minus 79, and you had a good piece of cable between the two. Before we get tremendously alarmed here, test at least one more receiver in the house, one more 2-meter receiver. And if it also comes up with minus 79, we got to look deeper. If the next one you measures minus 126, you're going to say, holy cow, that's a lot of decibels. That's a lot of decibels between 79 and 126. I wouldn't be super alarmed until I got down to minus 115. But when you get down to minus 79, you're way beyond the point of alarm. Something is terribly bad in there. And that's in the FM mode. I'd be curious to see what it does in the sideband mode, but it can't be a hell of a lot better. And there's a different procedure you got to use for measuring minimum discernible signal in the sideband mode. Howie, I know you wanted to make some comments on this. Go ahead, Howie. K2LAW in the TechNet.
Also, Dick, I did that without modulation on the generator.
That's exactly the right way to do it. Go ahead, Howie.
To say that most generators or most service monitors will have both the dB and the microvolts right on the scale. So that's one way to learn it. Yeah, 80 dBs is probably around 20 or 30 microvolts. That's all I wanted to say. And if that's a 3SK121 or 3SK122 transistor, they tend to go just by... I've had trouble with those two-gate MOSFETs. They don't have any protection. They're using the ICOM band units, and they tend to go from noise, from lightning, so I've used quarter-wave stuff. Just to make that comment. And you may have a bad dial switching. That's all I wanted to say, Dick K2RAW, WD2HW.
Yeah, minus 79 dBm, by the way, is 25 microvolts. A good receiver will receive a tenth of one microvolt. And if you're reading the dial correctly, minus 79 dBm is 25 microvolts. And power goes up as voltage squared. You see what we're saying here, John? These numbers, if you know what you're looking at, if you had some previous experience, these are very alarming numbers. Something is terribly bad. And so that transistor, where lots of people have known about it failing, there's a good probability you've got that. You're going to have all kinds of sensitivity you've never had before when you replace that. And you've done surface mount work when your eyes were better. Even if your eyes are not so good, when you're using the right kind of amplification, a bright enough light and the right kind of microscope, if you have any vision left at all, you can make what you want to see very visible. So the fact that your eyes are not quite what they used to be, that's not enough reason to give up the ghost on this one, John, as I see it. With enough bright light and the right microscope, you should be able to see what you want to see, is my belief. KT2WGB for any comments on that. K2RAW in the TechNet.
And Dick, please.
Please stand by, Howie. John, go ahead.
Okay, Dick, well, obviously I'm going to take another brand new ICOM that I have, 2-meter receiver. I'm going to make the same test on that, and I'm going to see where that goes. Plus, I have another ICOM receiver. I'm going to do both of them. I have a 7100, which is an excellent receiver. So I'm going to do that, and I will get back to you. And if we have time, I have an antenna question for you.
Yeah, where you've listened to a 0.02 volt coming out of a loudspeaker goes down to 0.002. You've seen a 10 to 1 change in voltage coming out of the loudspeaker. You've heard the amount of quieting. You heard the receiver go from a hissing noise to a fairly quiet hissing noise. That's what you hear when you do it with an exact AC vacuum tube voltmeter or a AC RMS, true RMS meter connected to the loudspeaker. To do a rough test, you don't have to connect the loudspeaker, because you're going to turn up the loudspeaker until, with no signal going in, you hear some hissing noise. On channel with a good frequency synthesized signal generator, you start turning up a unmodulated CW carrier out of the signal generator until you hear a moderate amount of quieting of the hiss coming out of the receiver. And the difference in microvolts between 10 dB of quieting and 30 dB of quieting is fairly small. Don't worry about it. That's going to be the difference between 1 microvolt and 1.3 microvolts, if you know what I mean. You're looking for the ballpark. Right now, this ballpark is not in Queens, and not in Staten Island. It's in Queens, if you know what I mean. We've missed the ballpark here, John. Huge difference. So the exact number of dB of quieting is minor. Don't worry about it. You don't have to go through all the rigmarole of hooking up the loudspeaker if you don't want to. And when you find out a little bit of quieting or a medium amount of quieting by your ear, your calibrated ear, as you turn up the signal generator with any other 2-meter receiver you've got in the house, you're going to get some very interesting numbers. Go ahead, Howie. Teach you RIW in the TechNet.
By the way, Dick, the numbers were 0.2 millivolts and 0.002.
That's the
new comment here.
That's still a 10-to-1 ratio, and that's exactly right. Go ahead, Howie.
Thomas, first thing, before he hooks up that generator to another receiver, I would take a voltmeter and make sure there's no DC voltage in the output, just to see what they're doing. You never know. Maybe you have a problem. You always want to test your check equipment out, make sure you're not putting, you know, 5, 6, or 8 volts of DC into the radio, you know, just so you don't hurt the radio. Number two, when I used to do a test like that, Dick, I would put either a speaker or an 8-ohm resistor at the output and use a, like, 5 or 10,000-ohm volt ohm meter and set it for 1 volt so I could see the difference. And then if I was tuning the thing, you know, I might set it for a half a volt so I could get better quieting. But you want to do like a 1 to 0.1. Doing 200 millivolts, you know, if you're using a DVM or something, noise can play tricks with your dick. But the most important thing I would do is check out that piece of test equipment just to make sure that it's not going to hurt any equipment.
Question in the comments.
Yeah, hold on, Wesley. There's a bunch of questions you've just given us, Howie. Are you talking about voltage coming out of the receiver being tested, or are you talking about DC voltage on the center conductor of a Gigatronics? If you're familiar with a Gigatronics signal generator, are you trying to tell me that Gigatronics, an extremely respected company building RF signal generators, have designed it in such a way that 5 volts of DC with some kind of reasonable current backing can exist on the center conductor of that output connector? You can't possibly be saying that. Over to you, Howie.
Okay, I didn't know what piece of test equipment is, but you always want to test it once in a while just to make sure that nothing touched or anything like that. That's all I was saying. I'm not saying it shouldn't be that way. You shouldn't want to have to test them. I just want to make sure that, you know, the piece of test equipment, even IFRs, you always want to make sure that your equipment's in good working order, Dick. Don't you agree with that? I'm not saying that. I'm saying, I know that's a decent piece of equipment, Dick, but you do want it to verify that your service equipment is working properly. Go ahead, Dick.
Okay, do that to be double darn sure. But Gigatronics is an extremely well-respected, very heavy, very expensive, very accurate, synthesized signal generator with 30 years of experience. I've been using those things for 30 years on some very high priority, expensive military programs. That is a serious signal generator.
Just came back from the calibration lab.
Exactly. The damn thing weighs 85 pounds, Howie. This thing is built like a tank. And DC voltage on the RF output of that step attenuator that can go to 130 dB, no way in hell. Now, The next thing you said is that you put an 8-ohm resistor instead of the loudspeaker. What's wrong with using the loudspeaker? With the loudspeaker, you can hear the hiss, you can hear the quieting, at the same time you're seeing the voltage. Why in the world would I want to put it into a silent 4-ohm or 8-ohm resistor instead of the real loudspeaker? What in the world is the advantage of doing that? Over to you, Howie, KQRIW in the TechNet.
Just that you don't have, you know, the for frequency. But you can use a speaker. I think you can use a speaker, but you want to use something around 1 volt. So you can, and you want to use something like a VOM, a regular analog meter. More important to use an analog meter instead of a DVM, Dick.
I don't agree. You're worried about the volt ohm milliamp meter or the digital volt meter in the AC scale picking up extraneous hum. When those two leads are directly across the coil of a loudspeaker, and if the loudspeaker is not sitting there humming with 60 cycle hum coming out of it, if you really do hear reasonable audio when you're listening to a broadcast, somebody talking to you, and if you're listening to the hiss and the hiss getting quieting, what in the world is wrong with putting a properly reading AC voltmeter directly across that coil? How in the world can he go wrong? In the case of the coil, he can hear it happening. When I put it into a 4-ohm resistor, you can't hear it anymore, and you have to believe what you see on the meter, and that's giving you a lot less visibility. Why in the world would you do it that way? Over to you, Howie.
I said you could use a speaker, but what if you want to use an analog meter so you can see the meter move up and down? You get more information. It's harder to visualize a digital readout. All right, I'll agree with you. Use a speaker instead of a 4-ohm resistor or an 8-ohm resistor. And if you even want to be clever, put a 1KC tone and use a SINAD meter. But I would still use an analog meter over a digital meter because you get more interpretation from the analog movement than you do from watching digits change.
If you're using a digital voltmeter that has very little damping factor to its readout, so that the digital numbers are jumping all over the place with noise, I'm going to agree with you. But some of these digital voltmeters, not only do they go down to millivolts and microvolts in sensitivity, no problem with measuring small amounts of signal across the loudspeaker at a convenient amount of noise, but some of them will have subroutines you can go to where you can control the damping factor of the meter so that it doesn't dance. But even if it is dancing, still a skilled person reading that digital voltmeter, in fact, some of the better digital voltmeters will have a bobber pole scale on it as well as the digital readout. And he may also own a triplet or Simpson volt ohm milliamp meter. That meter is beautifully damped when it comes to the AC scale. So I'd still rather put the meter directly across the loudspeaker winding rather than a fixed resistor, because the fixed resistor doesn't change the noise dancing problem, if you know what I mean. Over to you for a last comment on that, Howie. KQRIW in the TechNet.
Agree with you on the speaker. I will agree with you. Sometimes I've used an 8-ohm resistor, sometimes I've used the speaker, but I like the Simpson 260. The old-fashioned Simpson 260 is what I like. You go into the 1-volt scale, and you set it for 1 volt, and then you go to, you find out where the 0.1 volt reading is. I'm going to get out of here, Dick. Just wanted to make a comment.
Comment and a question.
Go ahead, Wesley.
Well, the comment is that at first I think that it must be just a mistake from the John side. The guy has absolutely magnificent shape of his equipment, and it was probably the mistake. I have two Kenwood 2000s, and I have a sort of idea what's going wrong, especially when I had a problem with the relay. So as far as sensitivity, I don't believe that the FET is damaged. Now, question to you. Valentine set to dB scale, as it does have a dB scale, could it be used?
Absolutely. I've used those Valentine meters. It's a true RMS voltmeter. It's actually a vacuum tube voltmeter, the older ones, Valentine. And the weirdness about their scale is that the needle bangs against the bottom pin when you're not putting in a strong enough signal. It doesn't have a zero setting, so to speak, and it's a little bit confusing to use those things. But yes, you could use that, but that's not the factor. You believe that he's got very good test equipment, and so do I. And you're thinking there's something wrong with the test. We'll soon find out. When he measures any other receiver in the house, if he comes up with minus 79 again, yes, there's going to be something wrong with a cable, a connector, an adapter, or whatever. Or maybe a gross error in the way the signal generator is working today, although when it just came back from calibration, I kind of doubt that. If he measures another receiver, and the other receiver comes up with minus 115 dBm for sensitivity, and this particular Kenwood measures minus 79, and it's time to open up the cabinet on the Kenwood receiver and look at the schematic diagram and start measuring voltages on those first few stages. Is the relay making contact? Is the diode switching arrangement working correctly? Does the first RF transistor have the right voltages on its source, drain, and collector, and so on? It's time to start digging a little bit more deeply. And if John is not so happy with the way his vision is working and his older ages of being beyond 50, it's just a matter of using a bright enough light aimed at the electronics. Even a person with poor vision, you give him the right visual magnification, and you give him a bright enough light aimed at the thing that he's looking at, and all of a sudden things become very visible. And move slowly with voltmeter probes and make sure that you're not touching the wrong things and creating a short circuit.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Be very careful with those voltmeter leads to make sure you're not touching the wrong things and creating a short circuit. With a bright enough light and some visual magnification, either a great big magnifying glass or your oscilloscope, your microscope, your zoom microscope, I'm pretty sure you're going to be able to see the circuit. What do you think, John? KC2WGB, K2LIW in the Tech Man.
Well, you're probably right, Dick, and if I can't, I know my limitations. I won't do it if I don't think it's possible. I do have a question on what Howie said. He said, set the meter for 1 volt and wait till it drops down to a tenth. That's not 20 dB. Is that an error?
First of all, when you set the audio output that's intended for a loudspeaker as big as 1 volt, in many cases, that is such a huge signal that you're beyond the linear range of the audio amplifier, and it might start giving you clipping and other kinds of distortion. Now, take reasonable sound output from the loudspeaker. In other words, you're setting the volume control so you hear some reasonable level of sound, level of hissing noise when there's no signal going in. Don't set the volume control so loud that the amplifier starts distorting, and you'll know the difference in that sound. Set it to a moderately loud hissing sound and measure your voltmeter across the coil of the audio output if you want to. But a skilled person, after he's done this test 5 times, doesn't have to connect anything to the loudspeaker anymore. His hearing, his ordinary ears will tell him, yeah, that's approximately 20 dB of quieting. 20 dB of quieting, a 20 dB power ratio, since it's a logarithmic scale, is a 100-to-1 power ratio. Because power is a function of voltage squared, that is a 10-to-1 voltage ratio. And there's a zillion ways you can get a 10-to-1 voltage ratio. 1 volt down to a tenth of a volt, that's a 10-to-1 voltage ratio, that's 20 dB. A tenth of a volt, 0.1 volt down to 0.01 volt, that's 20 dB. 0.01 down to 0.001, that's a 10-to-1 ratio, that's 20 dB. Any ratio, if you started off at 0.3 volts and you went to 0.03 volts, that's 20 dB. So any 10-to-1 voltage ratio is 20 dB. Does that make some sense, John? Over to you, John.
That's my error then, Dick.
Okay, let's have that one again. What voltage was on the loudspeaker when there was no signal going in? What voltage was on the loudspeaker when you put in the signal of minus 79 dBm? What did the voltage go to? The AC voltmeter read what to begin with and what to end with. Over to you, John.
Two hundred millivolts down to one millivolt. I'm sorry, 200 millivolts down to 2 millivolts.
Yeah, that's 40 dB. If I go from 20 dB of quieting to 40 dB of quieting, that's going to make 5 or 10 dB of difference in signal level of RF. It's not a linear relationship. The way the limiter function of a receiver gets captured, it's not linear. In other words, it doesn't take a hell of a lot more signal to give you a lot more quieting once you start capturing that limiter. So you're going to repeat the test, and you're going to make sure there is exactly a 10 to 1 ratio of voltage. And if you were reading the dB scale on your AC voltmeter, you would have seen 20 decibels of difference. You're going to repeat the test. Instead of coming up with minus 79 dBm, you're going to come up with minus 85. You're still a lot of dB away from what should be minus 120-something. Over to you, John. K2LAW in the second half.
Okay, so I want to go from 0.2 to 0.02, is what you're telling me, not 002.
The thing is that he doesn't have to connect to his speaker, because Kano 2000 has two outputs. One of them is switching off the primary speaker, and the other one is connecting anything in parallel to the speaker. So that output he could use to put his voltmeter.
I can go in the headphone jack, too.
Yeah, there's lots of ways you can connect to it. That's the minor detail. And with a small amount of experience, you'll eventually know what does 20 decibels of quieting sound like. What does it sound like? If I just started turning the signal generator so I can just barely hear a little bit of quieting, and you multiply that by 10, so to speak, you do that 10 times in a row, you just barely perceive the change in noise level. You could do that test, and it's nowhere near as exact, but you come up with very close to the right numbers. You'd be kind of amazed. But doing it with a meter connected across the loudspeaker, across the headphone output, wherever you like, as long as you get a 10 to 1 change in voltage on an AC scale of a good meter, you're in the right ballpark. And so when you do this test on any other receiver in the house, and now that you know what you're looking for, it's going to be very interesting to find out what you get. And because your particular Kenwood is known to have damage with that particular transistor, I think there's a chance you're going to find that or something like that is there. Now, you said you had an antenna question, John, so go ahead with your antenna question. K2RIW in the second half.
KC2QIQ with a comment.
Go ahead, Glenn.
Actually, mine's kind of almost like a question. Don't you need a tone or something, like 1 kilohertz, on top of the generator so that you can actually hear the tone in the speaker? Back to you, Dick. K2RW, KC2QIQ.
If you're doing the modern test called SINAD, 12 decibels of signal plus noise and distortion test, you're right. In the old-fashioned day of 20 decibels of noise quieting, you want nothing coming into that receiver except the broadband noise of that IF strip going through that limiter discriminator. You want real noise. Over to you, Glenn.
Yeah, I guess, so in other words, what are you listening for? Just, in other words, I guess the squelch all the way down, and you're listening for just the noise to go into, from the noise to quieting?
I'm very glad you said those words, squelch all the way down. I should have said that. The squelch has to be turned to such a point where there is no squelch action, where you're really hearing the noise coming out of the receiver. Is that what you had, John? Was the squelch turned to the point where with no signal you hear the noise coming out of your FM receiver? Did you disable the squelch function? Over to you, John.
Oh, yes, Dick, absolutely.
Fantastic. You did the right thing. So now, Glenn, as you can see, with squelch disabled, when you're really hearing the IF noise with no RF signal present, the real IF noise going into that limiter discriminator and coming out as broadband noise into that loudspeaker, and you measure the true RMS of that noise power. And by the way, almost every true RMS meter. The right way to do it is with a triplet or a SimSen, because the meter itself gives you beautiful damping. But if you're using a modern digital voltmeter, which has a true RMS function, in order for that meter to come up with true RMS calculation, by definition, it's giving you quite a integration factor, quite a damping factor. The needle moves slowly, or the digital numbers change kind of slowly. So true RMS noise power. And when you start putting a carrier into that center of that IF strip, and the carrier starts capturing the limiter, the high frequency noise starts disappearing first. That's why your squelch circuit looks for high frequency noise. Your squelch circuit says, how much high frequency noise is there? If the high frequency noise is starting to disappear, it says, aha, a carrier is present, I'm going to open up that audio, I'm going to de-squelch. KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, it's an interesting test. I guess, you know, I'm just thinking, like, so in other words, where would you leave the, when you're doing running this test, would you take the AF gain or the audio output volume, would you turn that all the way up, or would you leave it at quarter scale? Where would you normally set the volume control during this test?
Any volume control setting that is big enough that you're not listening to the hum output. I mean, I could set the audio output of my receiver down so weak that I could just barely hear a voice signal if it was there. And if I had the audio set down that low, and now I use a huge gain AC voltmeter looking at that audio output, I might be seeing as much 60 cycle hum as I am real audio. That's not a good test. You're going to turn up the audio gain control until there is a convenient amount of hissing sound, maybe at approximately the volume that you normally set the audio for when a voice is talking to you. You want the volume to be loud enough to be well above the background hum of every audio amplifier, but well below the volume where the audio is starting to distort. So some convenient noise power level that your hearing system says, aha, that's about right. Then you put your voltmeter, if you can, directly across that speaker coil or across the headphone output, wherever you like, and now you measure true RMS AC voltage, and you'll hear some amount of hiss while you're doing this. You start turning up the signal generator until the hiss gets quieter, and at that point, your voltmeter will measure one-tenth the amount of volts it measured before. Does that make some sense, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, I got you. Yeah, I actually have never done this test before. I mean, I know I can visualize it very, very clearly. But so in other words, what you're really doing is you're having a voltmeter across the output speaker. You're basically setting a voltage level for hiss because there's no input signal, and get some readable level that you can detect on a voltmeter. That's maybe an AC voltage. Hopefully it's within the bandwidth of the voltmeter, I guess. And set it for like a volt or something, and then bring up the signal level until you see it's about one-tenth of that. So say 1 volt to 0.1 volts. Interesting, Dick. Back to you. K2RIW, K2QIQ.
And Dick?
Hey, hold on, John. And the hiss that you're talking about is in the middle of the audio passband, because it's an audio output system going to a loudspeaker. I can't imagine any AC voltmeter, within reason, that you and I are able to buy that can't carry the audio frequency range, approximately 1 kilohertz. Yeah, the possibility exists you've got some kind of a AC voltmeter that's only made for exactly 60 cycles and rejects everything else. That's a weird, that's a rare instrument. Any reasonable AC range voltmeter, whether it's a volt-ohm-milliammeter, digital voltmeter, Valentine voltmeter, whatever, they have no trouble handling audio frequencies. I'll admit that you put 4 megacycles in there, it ain't going to read right. But audio at around 1 KC, I think you'd have to really go some to find an AC voltmeter that can't measure 1 KC of audio, even though it's broadband hissing noise. Over to you for that one, Glenn.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with you on that, Dick. I think even the dampened voltmeters, like the Fluke, they made that RMS version of it where it's, I think it rolls off of, pretty sharply after 400 hertz. But I would say that just about any voltmeter is going to be able to do that one on the AC scale. Back to you, Dick. Very useful information. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Question. Yeah, we've got John and Eric, Wesley in that order. I'm a little bit disappointed that the old-fashioned technique that was done for a zillion years of 20 decibels of noise quieting as a method of measuring basic sensitivity of a receiver. I'm very disappointed to find that that test that used to be burned into the brain of everybody doing FM ham radio in 1965, 1975. I'm very disappointed to find that in modern days that is thoroughly unknown. The SINAD test was invented for the testing of military hardware and high-quality hi-fi equipment because we cared about not only the sensitivity of the FM receiver, but whether or not there is any remaining total harmonic distortion in the audio system. So therefore they came up with this much more elaborate test called 12 decibels SINAD quieting, where now you're combining all of the total harmonic distortion when a 1 kilohertz signal is going through that audio system simultaneous with the FM quieting characteristics of the RF portion of the receiver. That's all combined into that 12 dB SINAD test. But that's much too stringent a test for a ham radio operator. Whether the audio system on your FM ham radio receiver had 1% harmonic distortion or 0.1% harmonic distortion, you wouldn't give a darn any day of the year. That doesn't matter to you. Can I hear the guy? Is my receiver giving me the right number of microvolts of sensitivity? Am I hearing him is the main thing you care about. Whether or not you've got an extra 1% of total harmonic distortion, it's not a hi-fi system. You and I don't give a darn about that. And as such, we've now gone over to where, we've gone over to the point where this 12 dB of SINAD has become the test, and everybody thinks that nothing else is valid. That's crazy. That 20 decibel noise quieting test was a beautiful test for 20 or 30 solid years. All of a sudden, because the hi-fi industry asked for something better, we came up with 12 dB of SINAD, and now everybody thinks that's the only way to do it. That's crazy. KC2WGB, K2RW. Go ahead, John.
Okay, Dick, I can see by my notes here. What I did was I took it to 30 dB instead of 20. So that was the error, and I will rerun that test again. But never mind.
Yeah, but 30 dB of quieting versus 20 dB of quieting. In the worst case, that made 10 dB of difference. I think it really made 4 dB of difference in RF signal level, because that's the way a discriminator works. Once you start capturing a discriminator, it starts getting quiet real fast with very little increase in signal level. You're going to find out that minus 79 dBm is going to go to minus 84. Minus 84 is not the minus 124 you're looking for. There's 40 decibels of error somewhere here, John. You've got a thoroughly open piece of coax cable. You've got a thoroughly open connector. Or there really is some damage in the front end of that receiver that you'd like to know about. And that's not a big deal. We're talking about replacing a $2 part. Getting down to that part, having enough illumination on it with the right test equipment, is going to be your biggest problem. But I'm really looking forward to you taking any other receiver in the house. Don't even bother connecting the loudspeaker to an AC voltmeter. Just connect any other receiver you've got to that beautiful Gigatronics you've got and start turning the dial until you hear some amount of quieting of the hissing noise in the output when the squelch is turned off. Do that with any other receiver, and maybe you can do that tonight. I'd be very excited to hear whether or not any other receiver comes up with a similar number or something that's 30 decibels better, if you know what I mean. Over to you on that one, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Oh, absolutely, Dick. Right after the TechNet, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to run the test myself again, and I'm going to do both receivers. I've got a quick question for you, though. I have a 1.5 meter cable. It's an HP cable. Why do those things cost $1,200, $1,300?
Now, maybe this is a very special piece of test cable which is calibrated in phase delay variation versus flexure for a precision vector vector voltmeter. Here we go. Vector network analyzer. And by the way, Mel and I and everyone else on this TechNet have for years now been using the word vector network analyzer, and that word rolls off the tongue real fast. And I'm suddenly realizing, I was thinking about this during the week, a brand new guy listening to the TechNet will say, what the hell is that? A VNA, vector network analyzer. And let me tell you what it is. I'm amazed that we haven't taken, you know, 2 minutes to explain what it is. From 1920 to 1970, you're in a good electronic laboratory, and you're about to do a test on a filter, an amplifier, a directional coupler, a hybrid network, an attenuator, some kind of RF passive or active electronics, which has got two ports to it, usually. In other words, it's got an input connector and an output connector. And you want to know, at your favorite frequency, what does it do? Does it have 10 dB of gain? Does it have 20 dB of loss? Is it flat versus frequency? Does it saturate? If I feed the signal in backwards, what happens? Whenever you've got a one-port or usually a two-port network, for all of those years from 1920 to 1970, what did you do to test that? Let me drop. In order to test it at your favorite frequency, you had to generate that frequency. You go running around the laboratory and you find a signal generator that puts out that frequency or that range of frequencies that you care about. Then you have to run around and find some kind of a detector, a crystal detector, a power meter, an oscilloscope, a spectrum analyzer, something that detects the signal that comes out of the back end of the thing. So you're putting in connector number one, you're connecting a signal generator. Connector number two, you're using some kind of a detector, crystal, oscilloscope, spectrum analyzer, power meter, something. So you're always combining a signal generator with a detector of some kind. And you'd like the detector to be reading out in volts, microvolts, watts, dBm, millivolts, something. Something is traceable to the bureau. So you're always connecting, you're always collecting signal generators and detecting devices to things on the bench. And somewhere around 1970, somebody said, why the hell do we keep doing this over and over again? Why don't we put inside of one cabinet the signal generator and the detector in the same box and save all this grief? And now I make sure that the signal generator frequency range and the detector frequency range match each other, and the power output matches each other. So you got the same dynamic range, the same frequency range out of the detector and the signal generator because they're both in the same box. You do that, and you've got something called a signal testing network. I don't know what they called it in the very beginning. Had they given it the right terminology, it would have been called a scalar network analyzer because without measuring phase, it measures amplitudes. You put in a right frequency at some amplitude, you measure some amplitude of what comes out at that exact same frequency in most of these tests. That's a scalar network analyzer. Let me drop. And once you made that leap of faith to put the signal generator and the detecting device inside the same box, somebody else came along from Hewlett-Packard in the roughly 1967 time period and said, gee, I'd like to know, what is the phase response? As I swish across frequency, does this thing that I'm measuring, the device under test, does the phase increase, decrease? Does the phase move more rapidly at the edge of the filter? I'd like to measure the phase at the same time. All of a sudden, your scalar network analyzer became a vector network analyzer. So what is a vector network analyzer? It's a synthesized signal generator and a synchronous detector, a very fancy kind of detector which measures amplitude and phase angle and displays it on that screen and gives you some numbers. That's what a vector network analyzer is. Signal generator plus detector all combined in one box, and oh, by the way, it measures phase. Once it can measure phase as well as amplitude, you've now got a zillion choices as to how you display the data. You can display it as a Smith chart. You can display it as a polar diagram, which is very similar. you can display it as an XY plot, where the horizontal axis is frequency and the vertical axis is signal amplitude. And you got a zillion of those. You can make the horizontal frequency linear with frequency, you know, 1 megacycle per box or 100 megacycles per box, or you can make it logarithmic. You can make the vertical axis linear with voltage, linear with power, or linear in decibels. My favorite kind of display when it comes to XY display is up and down is vertical decibels, either 2 dB per box, 5 dB per box, or 10 dB per box, vertical. That's my favorite kind of vertical display. And my favorite kind of horizontal display is linear in...
Repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
So a typical way I would set it would be if I care what's going on between 500 megs and 1,000 megs, the left-hand side of the screen is 500, the right-hand side is 1,000. That means each individual box, and there's 10 of them on the screen, is, if I got it right, 50 megacycles per box. Yes, 50 megacycles per box, horizontal, linear frequency, and 10 decibels per box, vertical. And now I've got, because they usually have 10 boxes or 8 boxes vertical, you've got 80 decibels of vertical display. That's a lot of dynamic range. And 500 megacycles of horizontal display. A very typical setting of a vector network analyzer giving you an XY plot. And now if you're tuning a filter, I could start off with a filter that is way off tune. But because the screen is displaying 80 decibels of dynamic range, as long as there's a tiny little bit of signal, 80 dB down, 1/10,000,000th of the amplitude of what goes in is coming out. I see some signal on the screen, I start twisting the knobs on that filter, and all of a sudden the signal peaks up. You try doing that with a power meter, and you wouldn't live long enough to find the right tuning. On that vector network analyzer, it pops out at you immediately. And then you start twisting the knobs until the filter gives you exactly the shape that you want. That's a beautiful piece of test equipment. It used to be that a spectrum analyzer is the most used piece of test equipment in any good RF laboratory. Let me drop. We've now come to the state of the art where I'm beginning to believe that as long as you can afford it, the most used piece of test equipment in any good modern-day RF laboratory is a vector network analyzer. It does give you, when it comes to components like amplifiers, filters, directional couplers, hybrids, attenuators, it gives you a lot of information in a hurry on that screen, and there's a zillion ways you can ask for it to display the information for you. The only thing it doesn't do for you is give you harmonic content. If my particular amplifier, when I put 500 megacycles into it, happens to be making second harmonic of 1,000 megs and third harmonic of 1,500 megs, and it's only making those 20 dB down and 30 dB down, a spectrum analyzer will show you that immediately. A vector network analyzer, in general, cannot tell you that piece of information. The vector network analyzer is very carefully tuned so that as it sweeps across that frequency, that detecting device is looking at that exact frequency going in and no other. While it's sweeping from 500 megs to 1,000 megs, and I decide to look at the microsecond while it's sweeping across 741 megacycles. The signal generator is sweeping from 500 to 1,000 to a meg to 1,000 megs, 1,000 megahertz, and as it sweeps through 741, my favorite frequency, at that instant of time, the detector, the synchronous detector, will respond to 741 megacycles and nothing else. So it is a beautiful, sweeping detector that looks at exactly that frequency and nothing else. That's the good news. It gives you a very exact answer of what went in the fundamental frequency and what came out in the fundamental frequency, and tells you that to the nearest 0.1 dB or 0.01 dB if you got a really...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
That's the good news, but it will not tell you how much second harmonic or third harmonic is coming out of there. That's its one fallacy. So it's carefully tuned to track what goes in versus what comes out, but it will not tell you harmonic content. Use another instrument for that. So I wonder how many people within the sound of my voice have ever realized what a vector network analyzer is. Simply a signal generator and detector in the same box, and they've now become very quantitative and very exacting. And properly used, boy, they can do magic. And with any questions or comments on this subject, give me a call, let us right now, K2RIW in the TechNet. 2KEY. Mel recognized. Anyone else?
Ben to Ocean.
And then Wesley in that order. Mel, when you first saw a vector network analyzer, were you as intimidated as I was in the very beginning in the late 60s, early 70s, until we suddenly started using them enough and said, wow, that thing can do magic? K2KEY, K2LIW.
Okay, the original Hewlett-Packard design was called a phase/magnitude display unit. Then they came out with scalar. They added scalar. Scalar network, analyzers, and then it became vector network, and then, no, network vector analyzers. Dick, the first one I saw, give you an idea how far back I go, the first Hewlett-Packard, the sweep generating was an electric motor in there, would you believe it? Over.
Oh boy, would I. The very early vector network analyzers in the late 60s, early 70s, in order to measure phase, it was a big deal to do it at RF frequencies. To make a calibrated sweep signal generator before frequency synthesizers became popular, that became a big deal. And they had all kinds of fancy mechanical devices with rotary joints on them, so that you could connect it up to your device under test without having real flexible cables. And they had precision 3-millimeter and 7-millimeter connectors. Oh, it was a real dog to use. And you had this external phase compensating network. Using one of these things in 1970 time frame, boy, it was a dog. And nowadays, a modern-day vector network analyzer has a built-in set of 2, 3, or 4 microprocessors that do a zillion calculations at microseconds, and all kinds of fancy data is displayed on that screen in real time. A properly set up vector network analyzer can easily sweep 500 to 1,000 megs. It's giving you a resolution of every fraction of a megacycle across 500 megacycle, and that data is being displayed on the screen 30 times per second. As you twist the knobs on that filter that you're tuning, everything is just flashing onto that screen in real time. Beautiful device. I'm talking about a Rohde & Schwarz. There are some other brands. I'm trying to think of the brand name now. And Ritsu, among others.
Advances.
Where they've got very non-real-time display, where you twist the knob and you wait for 5 seconds for the screen to settle down and tell you what's going on. They're a lot harder to use, but they're less expensive. But the real good ones these days display everything in real time. The data on that screen is never more than a small fraction of a second old. As you twist the knob, you see it happening. Therefore, if there's a real good test point in between, you're twisting one of the tuning screws on a filter, and you're about to tune at 30 degrees. And as you tuned it between degree number 15 and degree number 16, something really desirable happened. And that flashes on the screen, and you say, aha, that's the point. That's where I got the deepest null. And you go back to that in a hurry. When you've got it in real time, boy, it's a lot of fun to use. If you're using a machine where it's not giving it to you in real time, sometimes you won't live long enough in order to tune up a filter. K2KEY, K2RIW, go ahead, Mel.
KC2QIQ with a comment.
Glad recognized, but Mel first.
It's no doubt involved tremendously, you know, I'm just laughing at you'd say it about the size of the equipment. When I remember Tektronix came out with, at times, that scope, their first versions of their plugins, ones that had the plug-in modules, the first version, I'm trying to remember the number on that scope, with the power supply sat, for the scope sat on the lower shelf of the rolling cart stick. Would you remember that? Over.
555.
Yeah, but I know the ones you're talking about. In the very beginning, both Hewlett-Packard and Tektronix later on, you had a plug-in module for a polar display, another plug-in module for a rectangular display, different plug-in modules to cover different frequency ranges for the signal generator, different plug-in modules for the detectors. You had the reference detectors and the main signal detectors. You had this external phase compensating network. Oh, it was a dog in the beginning. It was a real rigmarole. And we've come a long way. I mean, when a guy picks up a modern piece of test equipment, like a 8722 Hewlett-Packard or the Rodin Schwartz equivalent, I can't think of the model number on the Rodin Schwartz, boy, there's a lot of calculating that goes on behind that front panel, and everything is all straightened out and referenced for you automatically and displayed in real time compared to what you used to have to do. It was almost as bad. It was a little bit better than using a slotted line. To make measurements of amplitude and phase on a slotted line, standing wave ratio, piece of apparatus of 1965, boy, we've come a long way. Glenn, KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Tubes and FDI 55 scope, I bet you don't know.
I think you're right. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting, Dick. You bring back some interesting memories. When I first started working for microwave power devices, I guess it was around 85, that one of the first projects I was put on was designing combiners and dividers and for L-band amplifiers. It was interesting that nobody at that time really wanted to do the combiners and the dividers because of the hassle involved. And around that time, they had all brand new vector network analyzers that came in from HP. I can't remember the model numbers off the top of my head, but it was great. So here I am, and I'm a new employee, starting in with a new project and all new equipment. And nobody knew how to use it, so I was kind of pioneering the equipment and the combiners and dividers at the same time. It was a lot of fun, and I'm just glad I didn't have to do it the old-fashioned way, because I don't think I would have been able to design what I was able to in the time frame that I did it. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Dixie.
To the 555, would you believe it?
Yes, I would. You were the young pup kid, fresh out of school, using brand-new test equipment, doing brand-new kinds of testing, and showing people how you do it, how it works, how well it works, and how to do it. I bet for a while some of the old-timers thought you were the guy that could walk on water. Is that true, Glenn?
Au contraire. Let me tell you something. It was funny because there was a lot of things I was coming out with because we had a lot of discussions going back. There was a lot of brain power there at the time and a lot of very experienced people. And we were looking at, Chebyshev versions of combiners and dividers, with Wilkinsons and all different types of mixes, and we were trying to come up with the best low-loss combiners to do a 16-way and all these parallel modules. And basically we had things built on pallets in sections, almost like modular, initially to do these experiments to see which would give us the best overall performance. So here I am, I'm ordering the substrate, at the time it was on Doroid, and we're cutting them, putting them on, and I'm showing all this performance, and I'm coming back with this stuff during the week. In other words, we had a meeting in the beginning of the week, and by that Friday, I'm already coming back with hardware, data, and everything, and nobody believed it. So, of course, everybody's got to come in the lab and check to see where I'm wrong, Dick. K2RAW, KC2QIQ.
Back in the days when those measurements used to be done on a slotted line, each time you switched the frequency, you had to recalibrate the slotted line, figure out where the peaks and valleys were, figure out how many centimeters to move downrange, do a bunch of calculations which you could easily get backwards instead of forwards, plot it on the smooth chart, whatever. To design that power divider, that Wilkinson power divider, and to take the data across all that frequency range, doing it with the old-fashioned test equipment, that was half a man month, maybe three-quarters of a man month. And here you are in a couple of days designing the network, getting it fabricated, testing it, and displaying the data. You were taking 3 weeks' worth of work and converting it into 3 days. Can you have any doubt in your mind, Glenn, as to why in the beginning they said, this guy is either lying to us or he's creating magic? KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
KEY again.
Yeah, Mel, pick it up after me. But it absolutely, Dick. I mean, that's what it was in the beginning. But it was a lot of fun, and the everybody was coming by checking cables, checking everything, because it was like not only was the data coming out, but there were certain things that there's a certain amount of modeling you can do, a certain amount of calculations you can do, but when you start putting the hardware together, there's little idiosyncrasies of these kinds of circuits that you can figure out, and other things that people weren't aware that we could do, to make better bandwidth and lower insertion loss and the We actually developed a whole series of combiners and dividers that eventually that started from the, oh my goodness, I think like 500 kilohertz to up to pretty darn close to about, let's say around 5 gigahertz, just under 5 gigahertz, you know, covering well high into the L-band, you know, the 2 area and higher. But it was interesting, some of the work that we did back then, and, you know, what was actually produced. And from that point on, I kind of became the combiner-divider guy, if you know what I'm saying, and couplers as well. Back to you, to K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Your job security was assured after that. Wesley wanted to make a comment for a couple of rounds, and then Mel in that order. Go ahead, Wesley.
Yeah, interesting. When I've got the vector network analyzer from Advantest, I was surprised with the fact that this thing is alive. It vibrates. It's, I compared that to the gain phase analyzer from Hewlett Packard that is much older. I'm sorry, this is my clock. Okay. And I was very much surprised. But there are a few things that I cannot do, simply. And I wonder if you wouldn't mind if I dropped that vector network analyzer at your place, your good place, play with it for a while, and eventually I could ask you the questions. And if you have a time, I would like to go before you say that you got to go. I'll go to the magnetic amplifiers.
Yeah, right now I'm going to have to turn you down on you bringing a piece of test equipment to me. There's a whole bunch of reasons for that. We're going to try to get the network, here we go, magnetic amplifiers. I saw that article that you mailed me, which is rather nicely done. Mel, you want to make a comment on VNA, go right ahead. K2KEY, K2RIW.
W2LAC.
LHC recognized, but Mel first. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, somebody asked a little few minutes back, I don't know, we started to answer the question, about cost of probes. Was that the question, how much probes cost for the instruments? Over.
Yeah, it was John asking, why does a piece of test cable cost thousands of dollars? And if you take a very well guarded piece of test equipment, in other words, it's got multiple layers to it with outer guard layers protecting the inner layers of a flexible cable, and it's got precision connectors on the end of it, and the cable is guaranteed to only shift 2 degrees in phase, and you bend it across a 90 degree bend, you know what I mean, with a certain bend radius. Those kind of precision cables, which most of the time we amateurs do not need, but if you've got one of those precision cables for a very specific test, and it saves you a whole lot of time where you've got to bend the cable in order to go from unit A to unit B that you're testing, and you want the test to be repeatable so you don't have to keep recalibrating the machine every time you do one of these bends, then in some cases these precision cables are justified. But if you want to talk about precision cables and precision connectors, there is a version of the Hewlett-Packard Vector Network Analyzer that goes to 110 gigahertz, and that 1 millimeter guarded protected connector on the front panel, you damage that tiny little connector that's got 1 millimeter of outside diameter, outside inside dimension of the outer conductor, you damage that connector, and you ask them to replace that connector for you and recalibrate, you just spent somewhere greater than $5,000 for a connector. And you can barely see the damn connector without a magnifying glass or a microscope. K2KEY, K2RIW. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, yeah, I can tell you real quick experience. I went back a good number of years ago. Remember, Tektronix and Fractal, they like to have long cables on their probes. You know, their scope probes and all that. A lot of them had some nice long cables. Well, you had to be careful. Sometimes they droop down off the bench, and you step on it, and crunch. They had a probe called the current probe, It was for the, now let me remember the series, the Tektronix series, the current, which one for the current series? I think it was called the 500th Tektronix series. Remember, they had current.